Dilation sleep. Spacers tell people that the worst aspect of starflight is revival. They speak the truth, I think. They give us dreams while the machines warm us up and map our bodies for cell damage. We feel no anxiety or fear, detached from our physical selves and adrift in generated fantasies. In my dream, I was joined by the cybernetic imago of Katya, my wife. We found ourselves within a computer-constructed sensorium. An insect, I felt my six thin legs propelling me into a wide and busy chamber. Four worker ants were there, crouched in stiff mechanical postures. With compound vision, I studied these new companions, observing the nearest of them deposit a pearly egg from its abdomen. A novel visceral sense told me that I, too, contained a ready egg. "We're gods amongst them," I told my wife's imago. "We are Myrmecia gulosa," she whispered into my brain. "The bulldog ant. You see the queen and her winged male?" "Yes." "Those maggoty things in the corner of the cell are the queen's larvae. Her worker is about to feed them."
"Feed them what?"
"His egg, my darling."
I rotated my sleek mandibled head.
"And will I also?"
"Naturally. A worker's duty is always to serve his queen. Of course, you may exit this environ if you choose, but you'll have to remain in reefer sleep for another 3 hours.
3 hours? Might as well be centuries, I said.
"Then change it. Something a bit less alien."
My imago dissolved the scenario, the universe. I floated in white limbo, awaiting fresh sensory stimulus. Soon I found myself brushing shimmering vermilion coral with 8 suckered arms. An octopus. Katya liked to play games. Eventually the dream ceased and I suddenly sensed my body, cold and stiff but definitely anchored to my mind. I allowed myself a long primal scream, then opened my eyes. The eyes I opened were the eyes of Uri Andrei Sagdev, who was once a main brain technician at the Sylvest Institute, but who now found himself in the odd role of starship heuristic resource, a crew person. Under different circumstances, it is not a role I would otherwise have chosen. I was alone, the room cold and silent. My 5 companions remained in reefer sleep around my capsule. Only I had been revived. I sensed then that something must be wrong. But I did not query Katya, preferring to remain in ignorance until she saw fit to enlighten me regarding our situation. I hauled myself from the open reefer and took faltering steps out of the room. It was several minutes before I felt confident to do anything more ambitious than that. I stumbled to the nearby health bay and exercised with galvanic activators, pushing my muscles beyond the false limits of apparent exhaustion. Then I showered and dressed, taking the expediency of wearing a thermal layer beneath my overalls. Breakfast consisted of fried ham and edam slices, followed by garlic croissants, washed down with chilled passion fruit and lemon tea. Why was I not concerned to discover our difficulty? Simply because the mere fact of revival told me that it could not be compellingly urgent. Any undesirable situation upon a light-skimming starship that does not instantly destroy it, probably in a flash of exotic bosons, will act on such an extended timescale that the main brain crew overmind will have days or weeks to engineer a solution. I knew we were not home, and that therefore something was wrong. But for a moment it was good simply to lie back in the kitchen and allow the music of Rudelius to envelop me, and to revel in this condition called life, to simply suck air into my old lungs. I who had been dead or near death for so long.
"Some more, Yuri?" asked my wife Simago.
I was alone apart from a servitor. It was a dumbbell-shaped drone hovering on silently energized levitation fields above the metal floor. Extruding a manipulator from the matte gold surface of its upper spheroid, it offered me the jug of pale juice. With a well-practiced sub-vocal command, I enabled my entoptic system. The implant supplied the visual and tactile stimuli necessary to fully realize the imago, the simulation of Katya, drawing it from the ship's main brain. Bright grids and circles interrupted my ocular field, then meshed and thickened to form my wife, frozen and lifeless but apparently solid. Copyright symbols denoting the implant company flashed, then faded. I locked her in Toptic Ghost over the dull form of the servitor, its compact size easily concealed within her body space. Her blunt silver hair fell around a narrow, pale face, black lips pursed like a doll's, and eyes staring right through me. Her clasped hands emerged from a long, hooded scarlet gown, inlaid around the shoulder with the insignia of the Mixmaster geneticists, a pair of hands holding a cat's cradle of DNA. My wife was a geneticist to the marrow. On Yellowstone, where cybernetics was the primary creed, it made her a virtual pariah. As the main brain-generated program took hold, she grew vivacious and smiled, and her hand appeared now to grasp the jug. "I was tiring of storage, my darling." "I'm not comfortable with this," I admitted. "Katya, my actual Katya, despised the whole idea of you. This illusion would have especially sickened her." "It doesn't sicken me," Katya said. "It ought to," I said. "Aren't your personalities supposed to be the same?" She smiled as if the point was settled, so infuriatingly like her original. "I see that," I said dubiously. The imago had been against my actual wife's wishes. When the melding plague hit us, I saw my chance of escape via this craft. Katya was unable to become a crew person, so I surreptitiously set about digitizing my wife's personality. The implant did all the hard work. It had assembled a behavior map of Katya whenever we were together, studying her through the conduits of my own senses. The simulation grew slowly, limited by the memory capacity of the implant. But each day I downloaded more of her into an Institute mainbrain, performing this routine for weeks on end. I have no doubt that Katya suspected something, although she never made any mention of it. Having completed my clandestine work, I then grafted the copy over the mind of the ship. It lacked her memories, of course, but I went to the expense and danger of having my own trawled and substituted instead, using software routines to perform the gender inversion. Katya's personality only assumed dominance when I was in rapport with the vessel. There was no doubt in my mind that the other crew persons had also arranged for their own fictitious companions. They too would speak to their loved ones, or some idealized fantasy of a lover, when they addressed the ship. But I preferred not to think about that. A lie, then, but my entire life had been a lie. Katya's imago simply the most recent aspect of it. But why had she awoken me? Or rather, why had the ship chosen to awaken me, and not one of the others? Janos, Kaj, Hilda, Yul, and Carlos still remained in reefer sleep, displaying no signs of imminent thaw. I upped from the table decisively. "Thank you, Katya. I'll take a stroll, admire the view." "I must discuss something with you," Katya said, "but I suppose it can wait a few minutes." "Ah," I said, grinning, "you want to keep me in suspense?" "Nothing of the sort, darling. Is the music fine?"
"Music's fine," I answered, leaving the kitchen. I entered a curving hexagonal corridor bathed in dull ochre light. An odor of Rudelius chased me, humming from piezoacoustic panels in the walls. The gravity that held me to the floor arose from our 1G thrust, and not from the centrifugal spin of the life system, otherwise the vertical and horizontal axes would have been interchanged. This fact told me that we were not at home, not approaching the cluster of carousels and asteroids called Shiphaven, in the Trojan point that trailed Jupiter. We were still on star drive, still climbing up or down from the slow time of light speed. We might be anywhere between Epsilon Eridani and Sol space. My stroll carried me away from the core of the vessel to her skin, where the hot neutron sleet wafted past us. The parts of the vessel through which I traveled grew darker and more machine-like, colder and less familiar. Irrationally, I began to imagine that I was being pursued and observed. I have never enjoyed either solitude or the dark. I was a fool then to address this fear by turning around. Yet the hairs on my neck were bristling and my sweat had become chilled. Most of the radial corridor was dark, apart from the miserly locus of light that had followed me like a halo. Nonetheless, it was still possible to make out a darker thing looming in the distance, almost lost in the convergence of the walls. I was not alone. It was a figure, a silhouette, regarding me. Not Katya's imago, for sure. I felt a brief terror. "Katya," I croaked. "Full lights, please." I jammed my eyes shut as the bright actinics snapped on. Red retinal ghosts slowly fading, I reopened them, not much more than a second later. But my watcher had gone. I slowly emptied my lungs. I was wise enough not to leap to conclusions. This was not necessarily what it appeared. After all, I had only just emerged from reefer sleep after several years of being frozen. I was bound to be a little jittery, a little open to subconscious suggestion. It seemed I was utterly alone. I vowed, shakily, to put the experience immediately out of mind. 10 minutes later I had reached the outer hull and was in naked space, or rather, seeing through the proxy eyes of a drone clamped on the outside with spidery grappling feet. The machine's camera head was peering through a porthole into the room where I sat. I looked pale and strained, but I did not have company. I looked away from the porthole towards the bow of the ship. The vessel, the Wild Palace, was a ramliner, a near-light human-rated starship. Most of what I saw, therefore, was very dense neutron shielding. The vessel required protons for its bosonic drive process. Ahead, a grazer beam swept space and stripped deuterium nuclei into protons and neutrons. Our Gauss scoop sifted free the protons and focused them into the heart of the ship. The neutral baryons were channeled around the hull in a lethal radiative rain, diverted clear of the life system and its fragile payload of sleepers. The drone sensed the flux and passed the data to me in terms of a swirling roseate aura, as if we were diving down the gullet of the universe. To the rear, things were eclipsed by the glow of the exhaust. Gamma shields burned Cherenkov blue. Within the ship, the proton harvest was extremely short-lived. Fields targeted the protons into a beam, lancing through a swarming cloud of heavy monopoles. The relativistic protons were decelerated and steered into the magnetic nodes. Inside each monopole was a shell of bosons which coaxed the protons to disintegrate. This was the power source of a ramliner. I had studied all the tech before signing up for the Overmind Partnership, the human cybernetic steering committee that commanded this vessel. When I say studied, I mean that I had downloaded certain eidetic documents furnished by the macro that owned the ship. These eidetics entered my memory at an almost intuitive level, programmed, of course, to fade once my contract expired. They told me everything I needed to know and little else. We carried 900 reefer sleep passengers, and we crew comprised 6 humans, each of whom was an expert in one or more areas of starflight theory. My own specialties were scoop subsystems, Gauss collimators and particle ablation shields, and shipboard in-flight medicare. The computer that wore the mask of Katya was also equipped for these zones of expertise, but it was deficient, so the cybertech said, in human heuristic thought modes. Crewpersons were therefore its heuristic resources, peripherals orbiting the hard, glittering core of its machine consciousness. Crewpersons thus rode at a more reduced level of reefer sleep than our passengers, a little warmer, a little closer to the avalanche of cell death that is life. The computer could interrogate us without the bother of complete revival. Our dreams, therefore, would be dreams where matter and number flowed in technological tsunami. I altered the drone's telemetry, so that the neutron wind became invisible. Looking beyond, I saw no stars at all. Einsteinian distortion was squashing them up fore and aft, concealed by the flared ends of the ship. We were still accelerating towards light speed. "Well?" I asked much later. "As you know, we've yet to reach midpoint. In fact, we will not reach home for another 3 years of ship time."
"Is this a technical problem?"
"Not strictly. I'm afraid it's medical, which is why I was forced to bring you out of reefer sleep between systems. Like the view, my darling."
"Are you joking? An empty universe with no stars. It's the gloomiest thing I can remember."
I was back in the cold room where the 6 crew reefers were stored. Katya's data ghost stood at my side, and Mozart warmed our spirits. Mozart's joyous familiarity drowned out all the faint, distant sounds of the ship, and the frank necessity of this annoyed me greatly. I was not normally prone to nervousness.
"Janos is sick," explained Katya. "He must have contracted the melding plague on Yellowstone.
Unless we act now, he won't survive the rest of the journey. He needs emergency surgery.
He's sick. I shrugged. Too bad. But SOP on this is clear, Katya. Freeze him down further. Lock the condition in stasis. I leaned over the smooth side of Janos's reefer, examining the biomed display cartouche under its coffin-lid rim. The reefer resembled a giant chrome chrysalis or silverfish, anchored by its head to a coiled nexus of umbilicals. Within this hexagonal, fluted box lay Janos. His inert form was dimly visible under the frosted, clear lid.
Normally that would be our wisest course of action, Katya said. Earthside med skills will certainly outmode our own, but in this instance the rules must be contravened. Janos can't survive, even at emergency levels of reefer sleep. You know about the melding plague.
I did. We all knew about it only too well, for it had crippled Yellowstone. The melding plague was a bio-cybernetic virus, something new to our experience. Yellowstone's intensely cybernetic society had crumbled at the nanomolecular level, the level of our computers and implants. The melding plague had caused our nanomachinery to grow malign. I permitted Katya to explain, walking to the kitchen and preparing salami rolls, stepping briskly through the dim corridors. All crew persons were fitted with such implants. Through these data windows we interfaced with the machinery of the reefers and the mind-brain of the ship as the ramliner cruised from star to star. Janos's virus had attacked the structure of his own implants, ripping them apart and reorganizing them into analogues of itself. From one implant node, a network of webbed strands was spreading further into his brain, in an apparent attempt to knit together all the infected locales. The experts on Yellowstone soon learned that cold does not retard the virus significantly, certainly not the kind of cold from which a human could ever be revived. We must therefore operate immediately, before the virus gains a stronghold. And I'm afraid that our routine surgical programs will fail. We can't use nanomachinery against the virus. It will simply subsume whatever we throw against it. I gobbled my rolls. I don't know neurosurgery. That wasn't on the skills eidetic. I brushed crumbs from my stubbled chin. However, if Janos's life is in danger...
We must act. How are you feeling now?
A little stiff. Nothing serious. I forced a very stiff grin. I'll admit I was a little jumpy early on. I think those ants gave me the creeps.
Katya was silent for a few seconds. That's normal, she eventually said. Get plenty of rest. Then we'll examine the surgical tools.
I went jogging. I mapped a sinuous winding path through the life system, feeling the megaton mass of the ship wheel about my center of mass. I was ruthless with myself, deliberately selecting a route that took me through every dark and shadowy region of the life system I could think of. I silenced Mozart and forbade myself the company of Katya, disabling my imago inducer. My thoughts turned back to the figure I imagined I had seen. What kind of rationale had flashed through my mind in the few seconds when I permitted the figure to exist outside of my imagination? Perhaps one of the sleepers might have thawed by accident and was wandering the ship in dismay. That hypothetical wanderer would have been equally surprised by my own presence, ergo the person was now hiding. Of course, the figure was undoubtedly a hallucination. One need not be drooling at the mouth to hallucinate. Indeed, one could easily retain enough facilities to recognize the experience as being totally internalized. After the uneventful hours of wakefulness that had subsequently passed, I was anxious to dismiss the whole incident. I jogged on, my shoes slapping the deck. I was approaching the nadir of my journey, the part of the ship that until now I had studiously avoided. Sensing my nearing footfalls, cartwheel-shaped airlocks dilated open. I panted through an antechamber, into the vast room where 900 slept. The chamber had the toroidal shape of a tokamak. 900 deep preservation reefers lined the inner and outer walls, crisscrossed by ladders and catwalks. I set about circumnavigating the chamber to finally purge my mind of any stray ghosts. Hadn't that always been my strategy as a child? Confront my fears head-on? I suspected that the boy in me would have been richly amused by my motives here. Nonetheless, I insisted on this one ridiculous circuit, convinced it would leave me eased. Most of these sleepers would stay aboard when we arrived in the Earth system.
They were refugees from the Melding Plague, seeking sanctuary in the future. At the near-light speeds this vessel attained between suns, large levels of time dilation would be experienced. Our clocks would grind to an imperceptible crawl. After 30 or 40 years of ship time, a mere 6 or 7 hops between systems, more than a century would have elapsed on Yellowstone. Enough time for eco-engineers to exercise the biome of the Melding Plague. The sleepers we carried had elected not to risk spending the time in the planet's community cryocrypts. In dilation sleep, the effective time spent in reefers was less, and therefore their chances of completely safe revival were enormously increased. I was jogging slowly enough to read the glowing name panels imprinted on each reefer. Men, women, children, the rich of my world, able to pay for this exorbitant journey into a brighter future. I thought of the less wealthy, those who could not even afford spaces in the cryo-crypts. I thought of the long queues of people waiting to see surgeons, people like Katya, anxious to lose their implants before the disease reached them. They would pay with whatever they could, organs or prosthetics or memories, or if they chose not to pay, they might consider becoming crew. My people made good crew fodder. It called for a certain degree of yearning desperation to accept direct interfacing with the main brain. The hard price of our bargain was the simple fact that our reduced state of reefer sleep meant we could continue to age as we slept away the years. That was not a bargain Katya had felt she could make, and I had known that I could not stand to lose my implants. Thus, the Melding Plague touched us. I felt bitterness, and this was welcome to me. I was happy to find familiar anxieties polluting my thoughts. I cast a dismissive glance over my shoulder, back along the curving ranks of sleepers I had already passed. I was being followed. The shadow was pounding along the walkway, halfway around the great curve of the chamber. I could barely see it, just a man-shaped black aperture in the distance. I quickened my pace. Only my feet thudded in the silence. Yet my chaser was also running faster. I felt sick with fright. I summoned Katya, but after alerting her, was unable to grasp a sentence, a command, anything. The faceless silhouette seemed to be gaining on me. Faceless was right. It had no features, no detail. Eventually I reached an exit. The airlock sequence amputated the chamber from me. I did not stop running, even when I realized that the doors behind me were remaining closed. The Shadow Man remained with the sleepers. But I had seen enough. It was not human, just a man-shaped hole, a specter. I found the quickest route back to the command deck of the Wild Palace. Immediately I ordered Katya to begin a rigorous search for intruders, though I knew, of course, that no intruder could have escaped her attention thus far. My Katya was omniscient. She would have known the exact location of every rat, every fly aboard the craft, except that aboard the ship there were no flies, no rats. I knew that the Shadow was not a revived sleeper. None of the reefers had been opened or vacated. A stowaway was out of the question. What was there to eat or drink, apart from the supplies dispensed by the computer? My mind veered towards the illogical. Could someone have entered the ship during its flight? Someone dressed as a chameleon? That imagined intruder would have somehow had to achieve invisibility from Katya's eyes. Clearly impossible, even disregarding the unlikely maneuvers required to match our velocity and position undetected. I chewed on my lip, aware that each second of indecision counted against Janos. For my own defense, Katya would permit me access to a weapon, provided, of course, that the existence of the intruder was proven. Alternatively, I might best confront the situation by not confronting it. I could perform surgery on Janos without straying into those regions of the ship that the intruder had apparently claimed as its haunt. In a day or so, therefore, this ordeal might be over and I could re-enter reefer sleep. The most faceless, inhuman entities I would have to contend with upon my next revival would be Solspace Axis Customs officials. Let them worry about the unseen extra passenger. Hadn't the Shadow permitted me safe slumber so far? I chuckled, though to my ears it sounded more like a death rattle. I was still frightened, but for once my hands had stopped playing arpeggios on the keys of an invisible piano. I absorbed myself in technical eidetics, outlining the medical systems Katya and I were about to employ. The gleaming semi-robotic tools were the culmination of Yellowstone's surgical sciences. Even so, they would undoubtedly appear crude by Earthside standards. This dichotomy galled me, even if Janos would necessarily worsen by the time we arrived. How could we be certain that we were not reducing his chances with our outdated medical intervention? Perhaps Earth would have accelerated so far beyond our capabilities that the equation was no longer balanced in our favor. Yet Katya would have weighed the issue minutely before selecting the appropriate course of action. Perhaps, then, it was best simply to silence one's qualms and do whatever was required. Drones assisted me in carrying the medical machinery into the crew reefer room, where my five colleagues lay in frozen sleep. I wore a face mask and a gloved jumpsuit, inwoven with a heating circuit. Katya would lower the room's temperature before slightly increasing Janos's own. "Ready, Yuri?" she asked. "Let's start." So we commenced, my eyes constantly flickering to the open reefer I hoped soon to re-enter. The room rapidly chilled, lights burning frigid blue from the overheads. Janos's reefer cracked open with a gasp of release cold. I looked at Janos, still and white and somehow distant. "Let that distance remain," I prayed. After all, we were about to open his head. Katya, in fact, had already performed some preliminary surgery. The skull had been exposed, skin pulled back as if framing the white pistil of a flesh-leaved flower. Slender probes entered the scalp via drilled holes, trailing glowing colored cables into a matrix of input points in the domed head of the reefer. The work was angstrom precise, rendered with a robot's deadening perfection. I had been briefed. Those cables were substituting for the cybernetic implants within his brain that had fallen victim to the melding plague. "When you have the top of the skull free, you should feed it back along the cables," Katya told me. "It's crucial that we don't lose cyber interface with Janos." I prepped the mechanical bone saw. "Why? What use is he to us?" "There are good reasons. If you're still interested, we can discuss it after the operation." The saw hummed into life, the rotary tip glinting evilly. Katya vectored the blade down, smoothly gnawing into the pale bone. Little blood oozed free, but the sound struck an unpleasant resonance with me. Katya made three expert circumferential passes, then retracted. I took a deep breath, then placed gloved fingers on the top of Janos's head. The scalp felt loose, like half of a chocolate egg. It eased the section of skull free with a wet sucking slurp, exposing the damp pinkish mass of dura and gyrus, snuggling in the lower bowl of the skull. I took special care to maintain the integrity of the connections as I separated the bonework. For a while, humbled, I could only stand in awe of this fantastic organ, easily the most complex alien thing my eyes had ever gazed on, and yet it managed to look so disappointingly vegetable. "Husband, we must proceed," warned Katya. "I have warmed Janos to a dangerously high body temperature, whilst not greatly increasing his metabolic rate. We don't have time to waste." I felt sweat beading my forehead. I nodded. "Inward, inward." Katya swung a new battery of blades and micro-lasers into play. We operated to the music of Sibelius. It was intriguing and repellent work. I succeeded in detaching my mind to some extent, so that I was able to regard the parting brain tissue as dead but somehow sacred meat. The micro-implants came out one by one, too small for the naked eye to discern detail, barbed hunks of corroded metal. The corrosion, observable under a microscope, was the external evidence of the cybervirus. I studied it with rank feelings of abstract distaste. The virus behaved like its biological namesake, clamping onto the shell of the nanostructure and pulsing subversive instructions deep into its reproductive heart. After 3 hours, my back boiled with pain. I leaned away from the reefer, brushing a sleeve against my chilled forehead. I felt the room swimming, clotting with blobs of muggy darkness. For an instant, I became disoriented, convinced that left was right and vice versa. I braced myself against the reefer as this dizziness washed over me. "Not long now," Katya said. "How do you feel?"
"I'm fine. And you?"
"I'm fine. The op's proceeding well."
Katya paused,
then stiffened her voice with iron resolve, businesslike detachment. The next implant is the deepest. It lies between the occipital lobe and the cerebellum. We must take care to avoid lesion of the visual center. This is the primary entoptic infeed node. In we go, then. The machinery snicked obediently into place. Our ciliated microprobes slid into the tissue, like flexible syringes slipping into jelly. Despite the cold, I found myself hot around the collar, iced sweat prickling my skin. Another hour passed, though time had ceased to have very much meaning. And I froze, conscious of a presence behind me in the same room. Compelled, I turned. The watcher was with me. I saw now that it could not be a man, yet it did have a humanoid form, a humanoid of my build and posture. A sculptor had selected 10,000 raven-black cubes, so dark that they were pure silhouettes, and arranged them as a blocky statue. That was the entirety of the watcher, a mass of black cubes. As I turned, it swung towards me. None of the cubes from which it was formed actually moved. They simply blipped out and reappeared in an orchestrated wave, whole new strata of cubes forming in thin air. They popped in and out of reality to mold its altering posture. To my eyes, the motion had a beguiling digital beauty. I thought of the colored patterns that would sweep across a stadium of schoolchildren holding painted mosaic cards to image some great slogan or emblem. I raised my left arm and observed the shadow repeat the action from its point of view. We were not mirrors of one another. We were ghosts. My terror had reached some peak and evaporated. I grasped that the watcher was essentially motiveless, that it had been drawn to me as inevitably as a shrinking noon shadow. "Continue with the operation," insisted Katya. I noticed hesitancy in her voice, true to her personality to the end. She liked games, my Katya, but she was never a convincing liar. "Lesion of the visual center, you say?" "That is what we must be careful to avoid." I grimaced. I had to know for sure. I scooped up one of the detached nanoprobes. In reality, the drones mimicked my intentions with their own manipulators, picking up the nanoprobe's platonic twin. Then I jammed it recklessly into Janos's head, into his occipital lobe. This reality melted and shattered, as if a stone had fallen into and disturbed the reflections on a crystal-smooth lake. I knew, then. My vision slowly unpeeled itself, returning to normality in strips. Katya was doing this, attempting to cancel the damage in my visual center by sending distorted signals along the optic infeeds. I realized that I no longer had control of the surgical tools. "I am the patient," I said, "not Janos. The surgeon is the one who needs surgery. How ironic." "It was best that you not know," Katya said, and then very rapidly she herself flickered and warped, her voice momentarily growing cavernous and slurred. "I'm failing. There isn't much time."
"And the watcher?"
"A symptom," she said ruefully, "a symptom of my own illness, a false mapping of your own body image within the simulation."
"You're a simulation," I roared. "I can understand your image being affected, but you, yourself, you don't exist in my head. You're a program running in the main brain."
"Yes, darling, but the melding plague has also reached the main brain." She paused, and then, without warning, her voice became robotically flat and autistic. "Much of the computer is damaged. To keep this simulation intact has necessitated sacrifices in tertiary function levels. However, the primary goal is to guarantee that you do not die. The operation in progress must be completed. In order to maintain the integrity of the simulation, the tuple ensemble coded Katya must be removed from main memory. This operation has now been executed." She froze, her last moment locked within my implant, trapped in my eyes like a spot of sun blindness. It was just me and the computer then, not forgetting the ever-present watcher. What could I do but continue with the surgery? I had a reason now. I wanted to excise the frozen ghost of Katya from my mind. She was the real lesion. So I survived. Many years passed for us. Our ship's computer was so damaged by the melding plague that we could not decelerate in time to reach the Earth system. Our choice was to steer for 61 Cygni A, around which lay the colony Sky's Edge. Our dilation sleepers consequently found themselves further from home, both in time and space, than they had expected. Secretly, we cherished the justice in this, we who had sacrificed parts of our lives to crew their dream voyage. Yet they had not lost so very much, and I suppose I would have been one of their number had I had their power. Concerning Katya, the simulation was never properly reanimated. The shipboard memory in which it lay fell prey to the plague, and much of its data was badly corrupted. When I did attempt to recreate her, I found only a crude caricature, all spontaneity sapped away, as lifeless and cruelly predictable as a Babbage engine. In a fit of remorse, I destroyed the Imago. It helped that I was blind, for even this facade had been programmed to exhibit fear, programmed to plead once it guessed my intentions. That was years ago. I tell myself that she never lived, and that, at least, is what the cybertechs would have us believe. The last information pulse from Yellowstone told me that the real Katya is still alive, of course much older than when I knew her. She has been married twice. To her the days of our union must seem as ancient and fragile as an heirloom, but she does not yet know that I survived. I transmitted to her, but the signal will not reach Epsilon Eridani for a decade, and then I will have to await her reply. More years still. Perhaps she will reply in person. This is our only hope of meeting, because I will not fly again, nor will I sleep out the decades.